Welcome, welcome to Freaked Out with your co-hosts, Liz and Landon.
What's up, everybody?
Today, we will be covering the unusual case of Cyntoia Brown, which is usually not something we do. We normally cover the victim side of things, but this particular case, I wanted to talk about it in reverse, so you'll understand what I mean a bit later.
Absolutely. Now there is a Netflix documentary called Murder to Mercy, the Cyntoia Brown story. You guys will want to take a listen to that and it'll give you some details and the ins and out of the case.
I don't want to waste any more time, guys, but I do want to mention one thing. We've decided that we're going to do something really cool. We're going to start sending out little care packages to one patron a month. And again, all you got to do is be a patron. And we will go through all the patrons and choose. All the things we're going to put into consideration would be, you know, how long somebody's been a patron, how some of these people are involved, like on Facebook, communicating. Just, you know, we're trying to show everybody that we really do appreciate you and your continued support. So, yeah, we're going to do this. And we've actually already chosen our first winner of the month.
Yes, we definitely, if you guys are sharing, you're getting people involved, you're getting people on the patron side, you're commenting on things. These are things that we're looking for in our people that we're going to choose. Now, this month's winner is Jenna.
Woohoo!
And we are very, very grateful. She is a longtime listener. A lot of you have been, and we appreciate all of you. We appreciate you, Jenna. So Jenna's going to be getting our first care package that's going to be sent out. And then we will be posting the details about all this on Facebook. So go ahead and join us on our Facebook group if you have yet to do so, because there is where you're going to get the chances to find out when the next person's going to be picked.
Absolutely. And the next month they're going to be chosen is in the month of April. And by the way, happy birthday, Jenna. Another shout out to you. Anyways, we are going to be doing this probably around the 15th of every month. So if you're a patron, by all means, all you got to do is just continue to keep coming and helping us out.
So right now we do also have a goal and we're trying to get ourselves traveling a bit more all around the U.S., Canada, everywhere that we can go, because we do want to start doing more cases in person. So that is our next goal. So we just have a few things to do to get there. So your guys' continued support and signing up for that patron is really going to help us be able to do that.
Absolutely. We've been manifesting this energy for a while now, and we're hoping that with, you know, you guys being here, you guys will be able to help us get there. And we'll post a lot of those details on social media. So if you guys are not watching or following us on TikTok or Freaked Out Podcast Facebook group, join us on Instagram as well. There's a link right through TikTok that'll take you right there. So easy peasy. We're almost at 4K there, and I have yet to put a bonus episode out. But I'm thinking once we get to 10K on the Insta side, we'll do another bonus too. Woohoo!
Well, with that said, let's get into this case now.
Cyntoia Brown Long was convicted of murder and robbery at the age of 16. And at that time, she was actually a victim of sex trafficking in 2004, indicating that a Johnny Allen had paid her $150 to have sex with him and that she feared for her life during that encounter. And that ended up leading to her shooting him.
Now, the prosecutors argued that Brown killed Allen while he was sleeping in order so that she could rob him. And then she was found guilty of robbery and murder and was sentenced to life in prison.
How the fuck does that happen? It infuriates me because she was only 16. A 16-year-old brain is not fully developed. And at this point, she was clearly in the company of a man who was 43 years old. This is one of those cases that make victims really scared to come forward and talk about anything that took place, let alone self-defense.
I agree with that. Like, people sit there and be like, well, why didn't you come forward? This, that, whatever. I mean, just look at the age. She's 16. He's 43. What would be the reason a 43-year-old wants a 16-year-old in their company? Obviously for sex and, you know, regardless, she shouldn't have been subjected to that, regardless of what happened. Sad, you know, he died, but she was trying to protect herself, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Now, on the night in question, which is August 6, 2004, Centoya had met the 43-year-old Johnny Michael Allen in a parking lot at a Sonic drive-thru in Nashville, Tennessee, and Allen was a real estate agent.
He was also a youth pastor and a Sunday school teacher, and he had started a homeless ministry at the local Baptist.
My question is, like, why the hell is the biggest pedophiles always youth ministers, pastors? They do Sunday school. Like, they're, like, grooming these kids younger and younger and younger.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in my opinion, I definitely wouldn't be leaving any child unattended with anybody that I don't personally know.
Absolutely.
And I mean really well.
Yep. No, I agree. Don't leave your kids unattended with these creeps. You never know. Now, they are going to try and twist the words around on this situation as much as they can. So I'm going to say it all out here for you so you get the full perspective. Now, according to the detective on the case, Johnny asked her if she was hungry and if she was up for any action. The detective said that she said yes on both questions and accepted his offer to take her to his house.
I mean, in my opinion, it doesn't really matter if she was up for anything. I mean, it's still called statutory rape. She was still 16, and he's supposed to be a pastor. He's supposed to be, you know, leading in the word of quote-unquote God, and you're not doing that by touching people.
Absolutely. And at the hearing, Centoya had testified. She agreed to have sex with Allen for $150, and she claimed that she never actually engaged in sexual intercourse. And according to Allen's friends and family, shocking, they denied that he had tried to solicit her for sex, and instead claiming that he was trying to help her. You know, oh, so nice.
I mean, of course they're going to say that. Like, why wouldn't they? Because, you know, they're in denial about his, you know, sexual being. Now, if he was really trying to help her, you know, he would have gotten on the phone with somebody. He could have called like a women's shelter or something to assist her, a youth shelter, anything like that. You know, could have called a police officer. He could have called a firefighter, anybody. You're not just going to take this kid home for any reason. And if it's late and you do perhaps need to take this child home for whatever reason, then you should have someone else there, like call your mom, call your sister, somebody, another female, and be like, hey, can you come over for the night or something? Like, I don't want to be alone with this child, you know?
Oh, yeah. In addition to that, they had a waitress at the local restaurant that claimed that she and other young teens at the restaurant felt uncomfortable whenever they were serving Allen. And the waitress said that he would hit on the teens regularly.
But they spin it like, oh, the teenagers are lying because his family knows him inside and out. He's good. No, he's a sick fucking pedophile. That's what he is.
At some point during this encounter, Centoya shot Johnny in the back of the head. Now, she used her .40 caliber handgun, and she actually ended up stealing $172 from his wallet and apparently two of his firearms and fled the scene in Allen's truck. She left Allen's truck at a Walmart parking lot and flagged down an SUV for a ride home.
Now, the police ended up finding Centoya at a nearby in-town suites. There was also claims of a neighbor that reported the detective that Centoya had told him she shot someone in the head for $50,000 and some guns, and that she also shot someone in the head last night and blew his brains out. The detective also indicated that the neighbor also said that the killing was for a fat lick robbery and that she had been waiting for a lick like that all week.
Apparently, after this incident took place, she contacted the neighbor and said, "You better stop running your fucking mouth about my business or I'll get you too."
Now, it's no secret that she had a pretty rough life. And it's also no secret that she was also trying to be tough. I do believe that she did, in fact, do these things because she was, you know, trying to be tough, trying to survive. It's like survival of the fittest, you know?
It's what she knew. I would agree with you, though, on that. I do believe that she did, in fact, make these claims as well. But I also agree with you. It doesn't look good for her case in any capacity. I do genuinely believe that she was lost looking for guidance and freaking the hell out.
Now, Tennessee has some pretty harsh laws when it comes to minors, despite her only being 16 at the time, she was tried as an adult. Now, Santoya never denied shooting Allen. Rather, she argued that the act was committed in self-defense. She claims that Allen intimidated her by repeatedly standing over her and touching her while she was laying in his bed, and that she believed Allen was reaching for a firearm as the two laid there in bed.
There were no firearms ever found, and Allen was discovered in a sleeping position when his body was found, and because of that, they took that as him not being in immediate danger, and he was also fully naked as well.
Now, on August 14th, Santoya was taken to a Western Mental Health Institute for an evaluation, and according to court documents, a nurse stated that Santoya allegedly attacked and threatened the nurse at the mental health institution and did not allow for her to contact her adoptive mother. The nurse claims that Santoya jumped over the desk, grabbed her hair and her face, and hit her and gave her several bruises and abrasions. And during the attack, she also said to the nurse that, "I shot that man in the back of the head one time, bitch. I'm going to shoot you in the back of your head three times. I'd love to hear your blood splatter on the wall."
And a lot of people witnessed this situation and all testified at the trial. There were people that came forward and talked in order to get, you know, a lighter sentence, claiming that Santoya had informed them that she had killed him just to see how it would feel to kill somebody. This particular situation, I get, it's very dramatic and drastic, but I honestly feel like they were just words. I don't feel as though she was actually going to do anything. And yes, she did hurt her, but that was because she was keeping her from her mom. And again, she doesn't know how to handle her emotions. She's a kid.
Now, further evidence against Santoya came from a phone call between her and her adoptive mother. During the call, she said, "I killed somebody. I executed him." She was found guilty of first-degree murder, felony murder, and aggravated robbery, and was sentenced to life in prison. She was only 16, going to a big girl's prison.
Isn't that crazy? 16, not even old enough to go drinking yet or get a lottery ticket, for God's sakes, play bingo, do anything, and now she's headed to jail before her life even started. Something pretty remarkable happened here with her case, though. It did go viral on several high-profile celebrity social medias, so they basically expressed outrage over her sentencing, including Rihanna, Kim Kardashian, Snoop Dogg, LeBron James, you name it. There were quite a few people that fought for her on their media.
Now, because of this, automatically the Tennessee Board of Parole held a hearing on her petition, and that only happens in 2% of the Tennessee clemency applicants.
At the hearing, several witnesses that knew her from prison testified on her behalf. Her former prosecutor, prison employees, local victim rights advocates, a local nonprofit leader who actually ended up running a mentor group for at-risk teens. And a couple of years of fighting this, they changed her sentence from a life in prison sentence to 15 years, plus 10 years of supervised parole. This meant that she was able to leave prison as of August 7th, 2019. Obviously, friends and family of Johnny was not happy about this.
Boo fucking who. Now, plain and simple, he should have, you know, left her alone in the first place. Since her release from prison, Santoya Brown has conducted numerous interviews, sharing her insight on the criminal justice system and everything that goes on there.
She has done a lot, but one thing I want you to know is that her and her husband actually founded a nonprofit organization together upon her release. The foundation is for Justice, Freedom, and Mercy, and the organization is aimed to empower individuals who are at risk of exploitation or criminal injustice involving the justice system.
Now, I can understand things from both sides, but I also believe that she had, you know, this tough exterior and held all the pain inside.
Oh, yeah. I feel like she also lied about a few things as well. And I honestly feel like she lied because she was a kid and that's what she's used to. So they're really going to hyper-focus on, you know, the inconsistencies with Elias. And I feel like we're going to talk a little bit more about those details. And I also want to talk about Johnny as well.
Well, tell us what you see in relation to what took place on this particular evening.
Right off the hop, I do want to talk about her childhood. She suffered so badly. She had no people to take care of her. The system failed her in general. Her family failed her. I believe that her adoptive mom was truly the only person that ever showed her love and affection, and she fought her hard. I can see that they had so many fights and so many problems between them, but this woman was tough love, but she was tough love in a good way. And eventually, Centoya really appreciated her. She reminds me a lot of the kids in the group home that, you know, I worked at, where they were all big, bad outside. And in reality, they were just broken and hurt. And of course, they have this huge guard up with major attitude. But they all need a little bit of love and support. And that honestly would go a long way.
Absolutely. I agree with you. Now, the system, everybody failed her. Now, what can you tell us about the night, though?
From what I gather, she was on the streets very hungry. He took advantage of that, saw she needed some love and support, and that she would be the prime suspect for him to be able to, you know, pay money and get sex. And from what I can see, she was really hungry, and that's all she cared about. She didn't think about the sex side of things. She didn't think about anything else. She even thought about like a warm place to stay, you know, maybe have a shower. She just wanted something to eat, feel comfortable, and she was down for it. So it didn't matter what he said. Then when they got back to their place while they were eating, he wanted to go right to bed. I do feel like they were watching TV for a bit, and I see that he was slowly undressing. I know she probably doesn't want to talk about these details because it may make her uncomfortable, but she is completely triggered by this in every sense of the word, so you guys don't need to share this with her at all. I see that he pulled out his penis, and I see that he asked her to touch it. I see that she was not engaging. She wasn't even looking at him. She was just looking at the television, trying to focus on the TV. He then told her that it was enough and it was time to go to bed, and that's where they headed. Now, from what I gather, she hesitantly followed him up the stairs. He told her to take off her clothes and he started to touch her inappropriately. She was extremely uncomfortable and told him she was tired. She was doing everything possible to convince the guy to get out of the situation. I think that if she had come to her testimony and said this a little bit better, I genuinely believe it could have been a different outcome. But I think that she just didn't have the guidance of, you know, putting it out there properly. I feel like she was just totally uncomfortable and triggered and just young and didn't really understand or comprehend anything at this point.
I definitely think she should have had more of an advocate with her, you know, during court, like somebody who was like, maybe somebody she trusted, but also somebody who could help her in a way, you know, like no kid wants to listen to their parents, their adoptive parents, nobody like that. But if it was just somebody else, another adult that she trusted, you know?
Right. Even breaking down like her story, like the lawyer could have sat down and be like, no, you're not going to say this. We're going to like fix it up a bit. Like, you know,
but right. And that's what I'm saying. Like, I feel like she had no one on her side.
Mm-hmm.
And I also feel like obviously with her life and everything going on and the fact that she was 16, she was still going through her own hormones, her own growth, for leaving, you know, starting to leave her teenage years, moving into that adult stage, you know, but she was still young. And then her life on top of it probably caused her a lot of mental health issues as well.
Oh, yeah. And like even just watching like her mother and her grandmother, like neither one of them like gave her any sort of like fighting chance. Like grandma got pregnant drinking, you know, then same with this one. You know, she ended up being born with fetal alcohol syndrome because of it. And that's another huge factor in this, you know. She absolutely had one hell of a handful of mental health problems. In addition to that, she didn't really understand how to express herself properly. She's doing much better now, which is beautiful, and I'm glad she's opened up to it. But I really feel like she is afraid to speak on the situation and kind of fix what she may have made a mistake on before. because I think she's scared that they'll come back and hunt her. Or so she's going to stick to her story, you know, just to make sure that no one messes with her at all.
Now let's go back to the bedroom. So what took place in the escalation from this point?
He had no clothes on, so that should be like a big sign as to why he was, you know, planning to do this. He had a teenager in his house. He was trying to help her, help him. Why the flying fuck would you be naked in your room with the door open or the door anything? It's just weird. And his family can sit there and claim that he was not a disgusting, dirty pedophile all they want, but he truly is. Anyways, from what I gather, she was laying next to him, and I think that he had touched her inappropriately a few times, and she was like telling him, no, don't touch me. I personally see she was so scared that he was going to turn around and do something. And when he did turn over, she genuinely thought he was going to hurt her or grab a gun or beat her with something. So she wanted to beat him to the punch. And, you know, I do see that he was like hurting her a bit, like pinching her and hitting her leg and holding her down. And she was honestly afraid more was going to come.
Well, now we're at the point where she was obviously traumatized by this. So she thought, you know, she was going to be murdered. She was going to be raped. Something was going to happen. So obviously we all have that fight or flight mode. And she went into that fight mode. She wasn't going to just lay down and take it.
Oh, yeah. I keep seeing that she may have been in a circumstance previously, not in the same sense of like murdering somebody, but perhaps someone, you know, trying to rape her, being successful with it. She was instantly triggered from that trauma and the gun went off and she shot him instantly. I don't feel like he was asleep. I do feel like he had rolled over in frustration. I also feel like he was trying to come up with a method to get into her pants without her freaking out. So perhaps he was making plans or trying to make plans as he turned around. I also feel like he mumbled something to her like, you're not the whore I thought you were, or something. And that honestly was it for her. Like, I think that's what really like set her off more than anything else was him calling her that name. And she pulled the trigger. And from what I can see, she was stunned at herself. She didn't even realize what happened. She looked around and saw the blood and was disturbed beyond anything.
Now, I truly feel for her, you know, and what she went through. She also learned what she knew, which was her mother was also somebody who was prostituting and also didn't really care to be a mom, you know? So how could she expect to have, you know, different results? She was living what she learned.
Oh, yeah. And her mother was only 17 when she was 8 months old. And she decided to start doing crack cocaine at that point. And, you know, how is she supposed to be a mom when you have this little baby staring up at you?
Now, you also had mentioned earlier about connecting with Johnny. What was with that? Like, how did that go down in any way?
I didn't intentionally plan to connect with him by any means. It just sort of happened. As I was watching and channeling the situation in general, doing my own psychic evaluation of what I had seen and writing everything down, it's almost like he wanted to make amends for what he did, which in my opinion doesn't happen often, especially with pedos that are up there, at least the ones I've dealt with.
Well, that's a little fucking crazy. Now, what did he have to say?
He shows me that he definitely was grooming her. And they had a conversation for a few moments. He had realized that he was watching her for approximately 10 to 15 minutes before he actually approached her. And he was going to give her, you know, his help. In his mind, he shows me that this was the time, you know, when he was still alive. He thought that this was a good thing. And from what he shows me, because like in his mind, it's like, oh, I'll give her food and then she can pay me back in sexual pleasure. You know, he didn't look at it in a bad way. That's basically the pedophile motto, honestly. He felt like this was the way of living, and his addiction to children was pretty heavy. He says that he definitely enjoyed the company of teenage girls, and he even dabbled in the teenage boy side of things as well, as long as they looked feminine.
Well, that is interesting. So at least he's admitting to his faults, I guess.
Yeah, I'm surprised about it too, like I said earlier. He's showing me that she was not the first girl he had brought back. She was not the first runaway that he had brought into his home. offered money and sex often. This was something he did consistently, trying to obtain young girls through his youth program, and hell, even offering the girls the youth program after he sexually abuses them. It didn't stop from him flirting with the young girls, though. He felt like he was doing them all a service. He didn't see himself as a 43-year-old man. He saw himself as a young 15, 16-year-old man trying to help these young women. And he sees the wrong in what he did now. He says that he agrees with everything she said in relation to what he was doing with her. And that's basically what I had seen. Now, he showed me another side of things that actually happened, which I never had ever seen before. So people that have, you know, damaged or molested people or children or killed people in the past, they are, you know, not necessarily willing to accept what took place. They don't ever feel guilt or remorse. And from what I can see, he actually did feel guilt and remorse and started to build upon his own lessons. And in the next life, when he comes back, he will have an ultimate punishment, which could be something like him being very poor, maybe being in a position where he's a prostitute or a drug addict. He may be born as a woman who decides to use drugs instead of taking care of her child. Like, there's so many different options, but he will definitely have an extremely hard life. And he may even be raped and hurt and things like that. But from what I can see, it's going to be different. There will be no connection to, you know, sexually assaulting anyone anymore. He will be someone who does have to suffer because that is what he did in this past life.
I mean, that's what he deserves, I guess. You got to repent. And a lot of people think that you just repent while you're here in this life. But no, the repenting continues on. And you continue to move in that direction of having to live and learn certain lessons and go through them physically. Because, you know, a lot of us are hands-on learners, and that's kind of like how it is. You know, you have to hands-on learn what it is, how that person felt like when you did that to them in your previous life, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense, which is why we decided to come forward and talk about this case today. I'm glad we've got the opportunity to do things a little differently. We're going to take a little bit more risks now when it comes to the podcast, guys. We might start doing things a little sooner on the case side of things too, one day at a time though. But I want to do things differently all the time. So, yes.
Well, this was definitely a different perspective on a case. Now, I hope you guys had learned something from this. I know I certainly did. Now, next week, we are going to be covering the case of Marilyn Shepherd. And this case is from 1954. It's something that's been outstanding for quite some time. Can't wait to hear our findings on this. Now, until next time, guys, stay freaked out.